You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 1st of November 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Chris Lord. On today's show, we'll look at reactions in the US, including President Donald Trump's, to yesterday's truck attack in New York, which killed 8 people and injured up to a dozen more.
This was an act of terror, and a particularly cowardly act of terror, aimed at innocent civilians, aimed at people going about their lives who had no idea what was about to hit them.
New York's Mayor Bill de Blasio there. My guests, Jane Kinnamont and Robert Fox, will be discussing this and the day's other top stories. A century on since the Balfour Declaration, we'll look at the legacy of this controversial piece of legislation that led to the foundation of Israel, and we'll ask why Turkey's president wants to be more presidential than ever. We'll also discuss the global wine shortage, a casualty of climate change perhaps, but will it be enough to drive climate deniers to the bottle? That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Christopher Lord. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Jane Kinnamont, Deputy Head of the Middle East and North Africa Programme at Chatham House, and to my left, Robert Fox, Defence Editor for London's Evening Standard. Welcome both of you to the programme. We begin in New York, where yesterday 8 people were killed and 11 injured in a truck attack on a cycle path near the World Trade Center in Manhattan. The suspect is Saifullo Saipov, originally from Uzbekistan, who had been living in the US since 2010. The attack has been called an act of terror, and in the aftermath, US President Donald Trump swiftly took to Twitter to condemn the atrocity. But almost just as quickly, he turned the attack into something of a political issue, criticising Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer and the Democrats, whose past immigration policies, he says, are to blame for the atrocity. James, we could start with you. We heard today that the suspect came to the US on one of these so-called diversity visas, or as we know it, the green card lottery. Trump has suggested that the programme could end. Does he have the political will to do that right now, do you think?
He needs to be seen to do something. But the problem is attacks like this are probably going to recur. We've seen quite a few of them in Europe in the last few years. They're easy to pull off. They're being copycatted. And now that ISIS is on the back foot in Iraq and Syria, which is a huge achievement, it's increasingly turning its propaganda towards carrying out attacks such as this in the West. So countering this kind of threat, which is appealing to the very wide variety of people who might join ISIS, who have joined ISIS from almost every country in the world, it is about much more than migration. Migration is a very easy scapegoat. But, you know, Uzbekistan's not one of the countries on Trump's visa ban list. It highlights the breadth of the problem and the impossibility of preventing it completely.
Robert, as Jane says there, we're seeing the collapse of the so-called caliphate as we speak. It's happening right now in between Syria and Iraq. Is this going to accelerate even more? I mean, are we going to see more of these attacks? What's that collapse of the caliphate going to spell in terms of potential acceleration of attacks in our cities?
I don't really know. And I wish people were honest enough to say that. The linearity of arguments. Islamic State collapses in Raqqa and Mosul. Therefore, they all come home. We know absolutely this is not true. Yes, quite a number have come home. Mm. But I'm sure Jane, who is really expert in this field, knows better than I, that a lot of them are deranged and will never be capable of doing anything. And this is a wonderful stick to beat Trump with. Actually, we've seen a very different Trump with this. Trump's reaction by Twitter, by previous experiences, and this is the first homeland terrorist attack, has been remarkably restrained because he said this man was a deranged individual. And he was very cool in his language about this. And we know we've got a hell of a problem because, boy, he's in trouble on other fronts with this, with cyberspace and so on, is how these people get galvanised, get radicalised, as Jane was saying, is a very, very difficult one. What I said at the beginning, it was not being facetious. This obvious A plus B equals C, which the cheap journalistic agenda is saying is absolutely dangerous.
Jane, just coming to you, when Robert says there about this reaction that Trump had today, which is, as you rightly said, it's quite different from previous incidents like this, Is this how a president should react? I mean, should he take to Twitter in this way and start calling out policies of the last administration and so on in the aftermath when we're, you know, when we're still literally trying to work out what's happening?
It's pretty easy to say no. You know, it's not the best time for a blame game. And as you say, very little so far is actually known about the individual's profile, motivation. No indication as yet that there was any direct link with fighting in Iraq and Syria. But I do think this focus on deranged individual is important because one of the useful things that leaders can do is try to keep this in perspective. This is not exactly 9/11. You know, the fact that these attacks are easy to carry out is scary, but it also shows that they don't really indicate a well-organised, well-financed organisation. You know, it's something that is relatively contained and certainly isn't some kind of chronic existential threat to the West unless Western leaders totally overreact.
Robert, just respond to that. I mean, that's an interesting point, isn't it? I mean, this sense of being...
Jane, sorry, really has triggered something, tweaked something in my mind, because I'm not saying the Clintons behave very, very well about this, as one would expect, because they're real brains, Bill particularly, and Obama. But actually, for once, we should praise Trump. Trump's MO is blaming his predecessor. We know that. It's like my editor at the Evening Standard always blames Theresa May for everything. Gosh, I'll be sacked in the morning. But, you know, this is the sort of stuff that happens. But Trump, by his own standards, was remarkably restrained because he didn't do what the alternative media did over the Oklahoma bombing, for example, where the Clintons behaved very well. The alternative media, Rush Limbaugh and the others, it was a worldwide conspiracy, and Lloyd LaRouche was saying it involved the Queen and the SAS and Saddam Hussein. And bless Trump for this. He didn't say that. He didn't say it's a worldwide conspiracy. He said, we've got a very difficult, deranged individual.
Why do you think he did that, Robert? What's the motivation?
Well, I think that actually, if you're surrounded by people who I admire and don't necessarily agree with, but I know a bit, like H.R. McMaster and Jim Mattis and John Kelly, actually some of it's rubbed off on Trump. And Trump is not a stupid man. And that is the biggest mistake that the critics make of him. Like the New York Times with their relentless, he is not stupid. And this is where we've seen a new variant. Actually, the boy may be in for the long game.
Jane, maturing of a statesman? Statesman Trump yet, do you think?
He is a clever man.
Yeah.
I think that's true. He's blunt and rude and offensive and all of those things. And that does get mistaken for stupidity.
Yeah.
But he's certainly picked advisors very well.
Just on the staying with you, Jane, I mean, with regards to Uzbekistan itself, I mean, this wasn't a country that was on his travel ban list. It wasn't, it was not something that he's sort of one of these countries that he's called out in the past.
He can't.
Why do you say that, Robert?
Because Uzbekistan is very, very crucial. I'm sorry, I'm treading slightly on Jane's thing, but I know a bit and have been there. And the fact is that it is very awkward, awful regime. And you had the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan, which has been such a feeder to both AQ, Al-Qaeda, and Taliban. And what vestiges even you've seen of IS in eastern Afghanistan. But this is where, again, somebody is giving very, very good advice because you need it as a forward base for US forces. And actually, there's, I don't say collusion, that's a tush and pish. No, there's agreement, I think, under the table between the Russians and the Americans about this. They jolly well need this and they've got to manage it. It is one of the really, really tricky in between places. And I think this is where actually you would get a synergy and understanding of the really high-end intelligence community of Moscow and Washington in understanding that. And that's why they haven't called out Uzbekistan.
And do you think they will, Jane?
The countries on the travel ban list are small, weak countries that aren't of that much strategic importance to the US. Iraq was on there. Iraq negotiated its way off. You don't see Egypt, where there might be an equivalent security concern, but it's really important. You don't see Saudi Arabia or the UAE. So I don't think the list is picked by the levels of radicalization in the countries concerned.
It's pretty arbitrary. It's who's a weak state, who's not really going to challenge us too much.
The costs of this are not very high. It may prevent some people from getting in by casting a really wide net, and it also looks symbolically like we're doing something about a threat that is actually quite difficult for us to fight.
But I think it would be a mistake, sorry to say, to interrupt here, that the CIA, MI6, the French intelligence and the Germans, who are principal in this, and Russia, of course, we must include this, exclude Uzbekistan. I think they are highly focused on it.
Well, we're going to look towards the Middle East now, and tomorrow will mark 100 years since the Balfour Declaration, the decree by the then British Foreign Secretary, Arthur Balfour, which effectively set the blueprint for the establishment of the State of Israel. The divisions and challenges that such a sweeping gesture created are, of course, still felt today. Back in 1917, the Jewish population in Palestine was less than 10%. Compared to the 730,000 Palestinian Arabs in the area at the time. Amid the violent tensions between Israel and Palestine today, many of those Arab voices are still going unheard. Jane, Mahmoud Abbas made a renewed call this morning in the British press for the UK to atone for the Balfour Declaration. And we've seen in October 274 MPs vote for the recognition of a Palestinian state. Is his opinion broadly changing in this country? Do you think, you know, when he talks about atonement, is this something we're going to see in the years to come? Some statement on this?
Well, there's a big mismatch here. I think public opinion has become, over time, much more sympathetic to the Palestinians having a state. And even if there's not a negotiated two-state solution, to some kind of imposed solution or unilateral recognition of the state of Palestine. But that has happened even as decision makers have basically passed the buck. So what you will almost always hear from any UK politician on this subject is, yeah, we wish we could do something, but it's all down to the Americans. And that is the refrain throughout the EU. And since the Americans never succeed in doing anything about it, you know, nothing becomes
particularly
done.
Particularly now.
Now you see that most diplomats just stay away from this issue because they don't think that they'll make any headway. The last person who cared about it was John Kerry. And it will be interesting to see how engaged he's going to be on it. He's coming to the UK soon to speak about Balfour and the Middle East peace process. But, you know, in most diplomatic circles, what's the incentive to go and bang your head against the wall?
This is a really interesting point you make, though, this idea of a slightly flailing administration. Therefore, in this country, MPs feel a bit more emboldened to make their claims, what you're saying?
I think that's true. I think there's a sense that there's not a big Middle East strategy, that the UK is not very active in this area. And so, as well as the elected MPs, the House of Lords has called for the UK to be more active in a major report. But I'm not sure many people actually expect very much to change. And I don't think that the public, while they may sympathise, feel the responsibility that Mahmoud Abbas is arguing that they should feel, because most of us who've grown up in the UK after the British Empire, we don't really think about the empire affecting our lives now, although it has done, of course. Whereas if you live in Palestinian territories, you can never get away from that legacy. And I think people there don't appreciate that somehow people here have largely forgotten.
Robert, you know, we could say that Balfour did not knowingly sign this declaration foreseeing the dispossession of Palestinians from their land and creating these enormous divisions. We can assume this was not his intention. Is too much weight put on the Balfour Declaration, do you think?
No, far from it. If you look in the declaration, it is the understanding of the rights and liberties of the people there. What worries me, and I come at this from a completely different direction from Jane, and I do not disagree with anything Jane has said. We're usually on the same page, and we very much are with this one. But I'm very worried about the historical illiteracy of journalism. Sorry, that's an extremely pompous phrase, but I feel it very strongly. I am a historian by trade. I'm a journalist by earning and artisanry for 50 years. And a lot of what's talked about this is just simple nonsense. Even the conception or the concept, we think it's all fixed and cast in stone from the 18th century to the 19th century of a nation state at this time, was absolute nonsense. What happens, and I've worked a great deal, as Jane, even more than I, in the region, is this. It's mutual exclusivity. Actually, the word used, there was Jewish activity, there was great Jewish philanthropy in Jerusalem in the 19th century. You cannot exclude it. This is what is wrong, and it's actually a shame that Abbas has used words like atonement. It's part of the apologist school of history, which is now so prevalent, which I would say is very often a substitute for constructive and proactive thought. Jane is absolutely right, and it's got to be the agreement which realises the Palestinian state. Palestinian statehood and Jewish statehood was not in the mind of Balfour. That's why he used the phrase homeland. Not justifying. He's a highly intelligent man, but do remember he was a man of his time. Basically, Arthur Balfour was a very clever, very narrow Victorian. And this is where he was working on the back of something else, which is infamy, infamy. They've all got an infamy. The Sykes-Picot agreement, that actually the great powers, in this very Machiavellian way, it was actually more like a carry-on movie, had carved up the Middle East in the denouement of the Great War to carve up the bits of the Ottoman Empire into the Mandates. Now, if you read the really serious stuff, which people like Margaret Macmillan's very, a granddaughter of Lloyd George, by the way, her wonderful book on the peacemakers, by the time at the Versailles discussion in 1919, they got round to discussing Iraq, Palestine, the Mandates and so on, they were exhausted. And that's why they made such a hash of the Balkans, Iran, Iraq and the Middle East. It wasn't even barely a work in progress. So I'm not pro either side. I can see the argument. But if you read it backwards, you cannot talk in terms of atonement, because that's a substitute of thought. And I'm very cross with Fatah about this and Abbas, because it's abdicating responsibility. They've got to get on and deal with the situation as it stands. Similarly, in Israel, they're stuck in the same time warp, because they think it gave them a kind of statehood and they can only think tactically. They cannot think of the arrangement that they have to make with the Palestinians, with Palestinian self-determination on the West Bank and in Gaza, because if they don't do that, the Jewish state of Israel is finished within two generations. Sorry, end of rant.
Jane, just picking up on that, I mean, with regards to Fatah and also with Hamas at the moment, I mean, if we look in the last few months, we've seen this beginning of a detente between the two. We've seen some reconciliation start to happen. It's very slow, admittedly, and we have seen these things before and they fell apart innumerable times before, but they're we are seeing some conciliations from Hamas, even on some of its key policies. I mean, where, when we look at that outlook there, does that shift things a little bit about when we start to imagine some kind of resolution? Exactly what Robert's talking about here is people actually sitting down and talking about things. I mean, when, if there's a potential of some reunification of the Palestinian territories in the future, does that shift the ball a little bit here in the whole thing?
I think what is shifting and what is driving this detente is the changing regional geopolitics, where there's no longer really an Arab-Israeli conflict. Mm. The Arab states that don't yet have peace with Israel, for many of them, they have a kind of tacit peace. They want to reach peace. They almost want peace, Israel to make peace with the Palestinians so that they can get on and do business with Israel and cooperate against Iran and political Islam.
We're seeing this extraordinary kind of an axis, two axes form in there, aren't we? We're seeing on one side, of course, you know, the Iran and Qatar and so on, and these old people who had their own various interests. And then, of course, as you say, the Gulf States.
But sadly, there's a very urgent piece of business, which is Gaza, and they've got to resolve that within 2 years.
And this is part of these current reconciliation talks, isn't it?
Yeah, because one good rule of thumb I have for the Middle East is never believe that there are only two sides. Mm. So, yes, Qatar is funding Hamas, which Iran has as well, but for now, the Israelis do not really want Qatar to pull its money out of Gaza. They don't want Gaza to explode. Mm. They don't want to be left being asked to contribute to the bill in some way. There is a kind of pragmatic accommodation over Gaza. Qatar and the UAE have fallen out, and yet UAE supports Fatah, Qatar supports Hamas, and they're not splitting that reconciliation apart. It does seem that there might be something pragmatic going on where actually the Arab states in the region are trying to break the deadlock in some small way.
You're listening to Midori House here with me, Christopher Lord, Jane Kinnamont and Robert Fox. We'll be back in just a moment's time when we'll talk about Turkey's president getting even more presidential.
Monocle's dedicated network of international bureau and correspondents bring the best global stories to our readers and listeners. Our eagle-eyed team of editors and journalists staffing Bureau in Toronto, New York, Zurich, Singapore, Hong Kong, and Tokyo deliver the best content from the world's most important regions straight to the airwaves of Monocle 24 and the pages of Monocle magazine. We've also got boots on the ground in more than 30 cities worldwide thanks to our comprehensive correspondent network. It's for this reason Monocle brings an up-to-date, informed and engaging commentary from Brasilia to Brussels and from Sydney to Singapore. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world.
Welcome back to Midori House. I'm Chris Lord. Still with me are Robert Fox and Jane Kinnemont. This week, Turkish authorities have been planning new presidential offices, which will help usher in the nation's switch to an executive presidency, which Turks voted for, let's not forget, by a hair's breadth in a referendum in April. That, in simple terms, basically means more power for the President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. It'll give him the powers to dismiss parliament. He can push laws through without much opposition. And despite his insistence that this is akin to the US or French system, it simply won't have the same checks and balances on his power. Robert, let's start with you. I mean, would an executive presidency look that different in the current Turkey? I mean, if we think Erdogan has extraordinary amount of power already contained in him, in his rule of law, he has a state of emergency, which means he can already push these laws through that he'd like to do. If there's an executive presidency, is Turkey going to look that different?
We of the cynical West, you're quite right, would say, why does he need to do it? Yes, he needs to do it to advertise that. But of course, he is very much, what is worrying about this is not only for the X million, 70, 80, 90 million Turks, and whether you include Kurds or not is another big question, as you know better than I, but how he looks in the region, and it shows that he looks north and east and south, and he doesn't care a damn about the West, because there has always been this consideration, as you know, with Turkey, very, very important member of NATO. But if you look in the Atlantic Charter, you have got to be a fully functioning democracy, and there's always been grave doubt from Turkish membership on because of the role of the Council of State, which was really the generals and so on. And it has always been this conciliar thing, but for the freak of Turkish history, and the freak in a very interesting way, and he looks more and more extraordinary as we look back at him, as Kemal Atatürk. But Kemal Atatürk, of course, was the dominant figure, and you see him everywhere. But here's a funny old thing. He believed in parliamentary democracy. He didn't know it very well, but he loved Westminster. He admired it hugely, and he really believed that this should happen. And he believed that Turkey could have its confessional side, but he abolished the caliphate, but he believed it should be a secular state. That's the point about Erdogan, is this is not only going to be a presidential state, but it's going to be an Islamic presidential state, which is not Arab, and it looks east and south, as I say, now what? And I think that this is why Turkey, more and more, both tactically and strategically, is looking like a real wild card there.
Now, I was in Istanbul when that April referendum happened, and I remember at the time the enormous feeling amongst everybody was, wow, this has been won really by a hair's breadth. I mean, the three big cities, Ankara, Istanbul, Izmir, all of them said, no, we're going to reject the executive presidential system. This, of course, being the big thing that could possibly see Erdogan rule until 2029, if this all goes through and Putin style, he can keep remaining in power. Jane, I wonder, you know, when we see that crack start to form in that infallible idea of a key support base across the country, I mean, really, he's looking on dangerous ground, isn't he, here? I mean, we could possibly see him call an early election in the next year. We could possibly see him start to talk about, even in the future, rolling back on some of these promises that were made when he went to his original executive presidency bid. I mean, how does the outlook look for Erdogan right now, do you think? Do you think it's less assured than it was before that referendum?
He's facing so many threats, and it appears that he and the people around him are developing quite a conspiratorial mindset, which suggests that he won't do the kind of consensus building outreach that could otherwise be a very positive and step towards more sustainability. Because on one hand, you have this happening within democratic processes. On the other hand, you have the aftermath of the attempted coup. You have the resurgent conflict with the Kurds. You have the threat of ISIS. So there are so many threats that Erdogan has to deal with, and imagined threats and connections between threats appear to be multiplying. So I think the outlook is pretty bleak. I think the trajectory that he is on illustrates exactly the reason why many countries adopt term limits. This is a leader who was admired around the world initially, and so much of it has fallen away.
And he's very willing to get rid of them, I imagine, in the foreseeable. Robert, just briefly, I want to ask you, Meral Akşener, we've seen the arrival onto the scene of this, you know, she's from the nationalist MHP party. She's presented herself as the challenger to Erdogan. She's coming from, in many ways, a strong Kemalist background, but she is still a nationalist. Does she have a chance, do you think, in an election?
I'll tell you what my gut feeling is, and you know Turkey better than I do. It's where what the vestiges of the military and the military conscience, because that's the thing that kept İnönü, as well as Atatürk in power, and it's what on earth they do. Because following what Jane said, absolutely again, same page, he's got some very strange bedfellows now. Because if you're playing up regionally to squeeze the Kurds and do what I need to do, my best pals are really Vladimir Putin, Haider al-Abadi, and President Rouhani. It's looking really kind of weird. But what this has done, which you can say, oh, they're so consumed with everything from Brexit to Trump to goodness knows what, but he has cut himself off from the West with this. And I think that this is what Syria... I don't know whether she will succeed, to answer your question, but somebody will come in. And because if we're talking... can I do a big pull focus, as they say in television news? Go back and look at the wide panorama. What we are looking at right the way through is populist plebiscites, referendums are bad news indeed. Because the people, the populists, think it gives them the answer that they want. And in the end, they produce more problems than answers. And he's one such.
Well, especially with these very slim majorities, which you've referred.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. They're these very slim majorities, and then everybody has to sort of stand in the wake of them.
This is
and
total victory.
That's absolutely right. That's absolutely right. Well, we'll stay just in Turkey's neighbourhood and end in the Mediterranean. Lovers of olives and a good bottle of wine should be rather worried. Global wine production is this year falling to its lowest level in more than 50 years, helped in no small part by freak weather in and around the Med. And olive crops as well are not having an easy time of it either. Robert, will it take a wine shortage to get more people onto climate change, do you think?
I don't think so, but because there are also other things in Italy where it turns out that Jane and I know a lot of wine producers. Actually, it's sort of like the awful cliche, and I wouldn't use it. It's like, some of my best friends are wine producers, but I've worked in Italy for over 50 years now, every year, and I'm a farmer's boy too. I mean, if you talk in Tuscany, and I don't want to be facetious, but the weather has been dreadful, by the way, and it's serious, but it's a bigger problem for the wine producers are the pigs and the deer that have been eating everything. Half a million cinghiali, wild boar, in Tuscany alone. But the weird weather has been extraordinary. A gelo, a tremendous cold in April, a fantastic peak in the heat in June, then down and then roaring up again to sort of central Saharan heat almost in mid-August. And actually they know that we've got to do something about it. But there's another thing, which is, again, I almost sound like Nigel Farage here. But the thing is that we've had the complete scandal and the payola of the common market agricultural policy, but it doesn't look after the small farmer that really produces the goods, because the small producer who produced the real quality in Italy and to an extent in France and in Spain, they have been... suffering very, very badly from this, and they're helped because they give us a sense of well-being, as well as at the bottom end too. Europe is going to have to provide more of its own food. So what I would say, blather, blather, blather, it's a wake-up call.
Jane, just briefly, looking a little bit out of Europe now to North Africa and the Mediterranean, sort of Eastern Mediterranean, are we not thinking enough about this? We're not thinking about what impact this is going to have on those North African economies, for example. What, you know, if we start to see Europe olive decline massively in the next few years, we're not really talking enough about that, about what sort of impact that's going to have?
Absolutely, because the world is trying hard to develop technology to grapple with climate change, but there's so many cases where simply applying existing technology with a little bit of investment would make countries much more resilient. Countries like Tunisia or Morocco where most agriculture is just rain-fed. You have water if it has rained, because there isn't the investment in storage systems. Something very simple that could help protect quite vulnerable countries.
Well, we'll have to hold it there indeed. Well, that was a great show. Thanks and to our producer, Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Tasha Kleeman. Our studio manager was Sarah Miles. Midori Harris is, of course, back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 hours London time. I'm Chris Lord. Thanks for listening and goodbye.